Kia ora, I'm Vincent Herringer and welcome to This Climate Business. Every week we talk to people turning the climate crisis into opportunity. Follow us on social media and please rate the show as it helps others to find us. I hope you enjoy the program. Mike Casey is the CEO of Rewiring Aotearoa, part of an international movement to accelerate the shift to a renewable electric-powered economy. And they've just published a report. Their first report is all about the electric home. Think rooftop solar, heat pumps, EVs, and so on. Mike is also a horticulturalist and a passionate advocate for decarbonising the primary sector. He has some unique ability to win over both farmers and greenies, and politicians just love being seen in front of his electric tractor at his Forest Lodge orchard, believed to be the world's first electrified zero fossil fuel cherry orchard. Mike, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be on here.
Good. Look, so many things to talk about, but why don't we start with the report, Electric Homes, which was an interesting place for you guys to start, because in some ways you would think that the bigger wins might be done in industry or, say, in transport, but you've identified homes. Why? Why did you pick on residential as the place to start with electrifying New Zealand?
Because it's where the true win-win is available right now. And so when I say that, I mean that the technology is available right now to decarbonize or lower emissions within our homes. But not only that, there is a huge amount of economic savings available to everyday New Zealanders who look at going down this path. And so our report was really just designed about illustrating that New Zealand has essentially reached a tipping point where it is always going to be cheaper for you to choose the electric option over a fossil fuel option when it comes to the machines that you use to run your lifestyle. So that's everything from the way we cook our food, to the way that we heat our rooms, to the way we heat our hot water, to the way that we travel around this beautiful country of ours. And so identifying that, it's just, I feel the key, I'm an orchardist, I love low-hanging fruit, and we sort of have just realized the low-hanging fruit potential that is here that isn't available in some of the other spaces that also, I think, puts a very unique positive spin on climate action in New Zealand, where ultimately, we can win over everybody by talking about a combination of emissions and money, but ultimately everybody gets what they want. Mm. And by starting and doing that in the homes, that's the first place that we can start. There are a lot more examples out there in New Zealand with our small businesses and within our communities, but a home is a very simple example and a simple thing that we can get into quite detailed numbers on to prove our point. So very long-winded answer is the way we say why we started with homes. But the other big thing about New Zealanders is that we all live in homes. So what better way to relate to every New Zealander than to talk about the homes in which we live in?
It's an interesting way into the topic, isn't it? Because you've avoided the jargon of saving the planet, of talking about decarbonisation, of these words that have typified the climate movement. Is that a deliberate PR marketing attempt to enter the conversation at a different point and use language that is different from what we've all grown used to in climate advocacy?
Well, I think the clear example for me was watching the leaders debate last year leading up to our election, where both the Chrises were asked a very frank question about what they were doing around climate. And both of them said recycling. Now, obviously, recycling is a very good thing to be doing, but it's not really a way that we're going to be reducing, our emissions necessarily. And I sort of realized at that point that New Zealanders really don't have a good answer for what they are doing as individuals. And the reason for it is the way that we categorize our emissions going back, multiple decades, they haven't really categorized emissions into what I would call the human factor, or they haven't really categorized them around the humans that make the decisions. And so we've always seen household emissions as being very, very low because our cars are involved in, you know, in transport. The food that we eat is involved in agriculture. The machines that we have, you know, all the upstream emissions from the way that we heat our hot water with gas, for example, that's all included in separate energy sectors. But when you actually look at the decisions around or the human decisions that make up emissions, you actually start to realize that household emissions are actually a significant portion of New Zealand's emissions. They just haven't been accounted for in the right way, and therefore we haven't empowered New Zealanders to actually examine them. And what our report really illustrates is if you just recategorize or remap our New Zealand's emissions inventory to make it about where human decisions are, you know, the typical New Zealand home is, 31% of our domestic emissions comes from households, and that's a staggering, I think, 14% of our gross emissions inventory, which is actually really staggering, and it sort of makes you realise that actually there's a huge amount of opportunity for individuals to decarbonize their lives and actually have that make a massive impact on our country's emissions as a whole. So that's sort of really, you know, diving a bit deeper into why we've gone about doing that remapping. And it really is to sort of show people that actually as an individual or as a household, you can have a significant difference.
What have you identified in a home that would actually make the difference? You talk about low-hanging fruit and you really are the only person in New Zealand who can use that term, I agree, but because you're a horticulturalist. What in the home have you identified are the things that would make a difference to the decarbonisation process?
So there's six machines that make up what we call an electric home. And, of course, we in this report we did what we would consider the average typical home of New Zealand, and everyone will immediately go, well, my home is not the average typical home of New Zealand for a variety of nuances, and I totally get that. But what we've essentially looked at are what are the machines that exist inside the home and what is their typical average use? And so obviously there's a way we cook our food. So the stovetops, which are often run by gas, and there's a difference between the North Island and the South Island between a reticulated gas network in the North Island versus LPG tanks on the side of your house in the South Island. That gas could also be used to heat our hot water. But we also have, you know, electric options available, whether it be resistive cylinders right through to hot water heat pumps. That gas could also be used to heat our homes, which is a terrible idea because it's so expensive, let alone the health implications of it. But there are also electric options available, including the incredible efficiency gains that you can have through spatial heat pumps. And then when you add those together, you then have your petrol car. And your petrol car, of course, could be made electric. And when you put those four different, I guess, machines in the household, when they're all electric, we then also looked at, well, what happens if you put solar and backup batteries into your household? And how does that affect the economics of everything? Because surely generating your own energy is the cheapest energy now that you're ever going to get. And this report has set out to indeed prove that as well. And I think the overall outcome is that electrification of the entire household is greater than the sum of its individual parts. But in order to go down this path, we have to look at the individual paths, because everybody is partway through an electrification journey. You know, one person might have a hybrid, another person might have a gas, you know, hot water cylinder, but have moved to induction cooking, that kind of thing. So we need to look at each individual machine and then look at the group benefits of electrifying all of them, and what that means.
When you sum it up, you've said that there's savings of around about $4,500 per year that could be saved if you, as a household, moved, you know, to that electric future. But what there is in between that, Mike, is a barrier, right? There is a capital barrier. There is an install, replacing appliances, which is really a CapEx exercise, which is difficult for people living in a cost of living crisis. Are you in danger of blaming the victim here? We are deploying the technology that has been sold to us as residents.
Yep.
We're working in a system that we've inherited. We've been told, and so on, you know, by governments, by industry, Are you falling into the trap of actually not identifying the real culprits or the real change makers in this, which is industry and government?
Yeah, I think that's a superb question, and one that actually hasn't been posed to me in that way before. But 100%, it's not the average New Zealander's fault that we are now in the situation that we're in. And it's really the way that we're sort of describing it now is to really look at the financial benefits from electrification, because that's something that you can sort of have a conversation with everyone in New Zealand about, no matter what their political beliefs are, no matter what their scientific beliefs are, no matter whether they're conservative or liberal or anything like that. You can start to talk about the win-win scenario that that is happening here. The last thing I think we should be doing is guilting anybody for the machines that they already have in their households, because a lot of the time those machines would have been inherited when they bought their house. But also the upfront capital cost is a real barrier to getting a lot of this electrification done. And we must also remember that 47% of all New Zealanders live in rental properties, where the decisions around these machines are a lot harder to make. And so really what Rewiring's Kaupapa now is to highlight how significant the savings are for electrification, so that everyone in New Zealand knows they are always better off buying an electric machine for their home. And then the second part of our kaupapa is, great, Vincent, you know that this is the right decision now from an economic perspective, not just a carbon perspective, but how are you going to be able to make that decision, right? Now, some of us are in the luxurious position where we own our own homes and have some disposable income up our sleeve that allows us to make these decisions up front. Other people who are renters cannot make these decisions. And many people, we are in a bit of a cost of living crunch at the moment, which means that a lot of people are living paycheck to paycheck and can't afford to accelerate these decisions. Mm. And so really what we're talking about now is, well, if you're a renter, the next time a fossil fuel machine breaks, ask your landlord to replace it with an electric one. If you are not in a position to accelerate the decommissioning of fossil fuels in your home, the next time you need to make an electric a purchasing decision, make it electric. On the other side of that, the flip side of that is, we've made enemies out of very common people in the climate movement a lot of the time. You've seen what happened with, chefs standing up against the removal of gas in certain countries around the world because they like to cook with gas. Yeah. You've also probably all had a conversation with a car enthusiast around climate, and that's because we have made enemies out of these people. And I think the number one thing that I'm trying to do is put a positive spin on this. If I have a car enthusiast come to my farm, I'm always saying, just electrify everything in your life that you don't love, because that's the economic decision. You're not driving a hot rod around the racetrack on the weekends for an economic decision. You're doing that because you genuinely love it. And I'm here to talk about the economics of electrification. And I guess the economics of decarbonisation. So you're going to love your car. You probably don't love your gas water heater. And that's the path that we can start to go down to accelerate this transition.
I want to explore that a little bit more, but just one more question about the report. How has it landed? And do you think that there is, we've seen the kind of rolling back of certain incentives, such as I think the GIDI scheme is going to come to an end. I think the clean car mandate is going to come to an end. Are your messages landing in a positive way with government or with industry that might want to replace those things? Obviously not with the same, but something different that actually could deliver a similar incentive to get over this capital hurdle of replacing machines.
Yeah, last weekend we were in Wellington. We launched the report in Wellington. I would have met with 8 or 9 different government agencies and departments to talk through the report, which has been, I think, really highly received. We met with almost all of the political parties as well, again, really highly received. And so I think on that front, I think people are finding the new narrative quite refreshing. We are seeing a retrenchment of, things such as the rebate scheme for electric vehicles. We're seeing a retrenchment of GIDI. But turning around and focusing on the household and making people aware that even after the clean car rebate disappears and even after RUX is put on electric vehicles, the total cost of ownership of an electric vehicle is still cheaper than that of a petrol vehicle, is a really strong narrative that we can take no matter what the current political narrative has become. And I think those, you know, like when we look at GIDI and we look at Clean Car, the Clean Car Subsidy, I mean, both of them have done a fantastic job in the areas that they were focused on. But at the Rewiring sort of co-pupper, or our mission, is that this energy transition is inevitable. It's going to happen. But how do we make sure that no one gets left behind on this energy transition? Mm. And the perfect example of the clean car rebate is you look at it and you go, yes, it was really good at helping drive the adoption of electric vehicles in New Zealand. But it didn't help the single parent in South Auckland get into an electric vehicle. And that single parent would have probably benefited from the cost and operational savings more than anyone else, you know, in New Zealand, because of the amount of kilometres they need to drive. Mm. So that's the sort of part where it becomes a bit more of a mixed policy solution, where we think the real answer is around, not around necessarily saying that whether a rebate or GIDI was good or bad. They have their strengths, they have their weaknesses, but really, how do we make sure that everyone in New Zealand has the ability to make the right decision? And that really comes down to figuring out how to fix the finance. So that what the key thing that our report really illustrates is that, you know, if you're building a brand new home, and you're making all the decisions up front on what machines to put in your home, including your electric vehicle, you know, you will save $4,500 a year by choosing the fully electric option over the petrol option, including the additional upfront cost of capital, including the additional upfront cost, right? So the cost and the financing of that. And, you know, if you can get low interest finance, that's fantastic. You're going to get the majority of that $4,500. But even at a market interest rate of 5.5%, that's a figure that we picked because it was an average over the last sort of 15 years, I think, you're still looking at a savings of $1,500. And so if you're building a new home, you know, that's a really easy narrative now. You can be like, why would you ever put a fossil fuel appliance in it again? But the majority of us aren't building new homes. We live in existing homes with existing appliances that need to be replaced one at a time. And so the other part was, well, what's the positive strategy around that? It's not to guilt you, Vincent, because you might use gas in your home to heat your hot water and your cooking. It's to say, no, hey, Vincent, let's put you on the right path by making sure the next decision is electric.
There's no gas central heating in my home installed.
I was using Vincent as a very hypothetical example.
Well, I am a living, breathing example of the kind of conniptions that you get yourself into. So I live in a big old drafty villa that has got a gas-powered central heating system, because it was about a fifth of the price of an electric system, which at the time made a really sense. You know, I made a sensible, rational decision for my family and for where I was at.
Correct.
Even though I knew that I was committed to, you know, lowering my carbon footprint as an individual, as a citizen, and what I stood for and stuff, it's such an interesting trade-off that you have to make around economics. And your point is that the economics now of electrics are coming down to the point where, even if you do include that capital expenditure, there is a way of earning that back.
That's exactly right. If you were to make that same decision again, I would, you know, I think you would be making the electric decision when you do your numbers again. We know that their gas central heating system's probably got a 15-year lifetime on it. So when we're looking at designing your individual home's pathway to net zero, if it's a reasonably new system, that's going to be one of the last things that you replace. Mm. But even then, with the rising costs of gas and LPG and the lowering costs of rooftop solar, you're probably going to end up ripping that out before its lifetime is up, simply because the economics stack up for you to do so.
Yeah, that's true. I may wear another jumper.
A good option.
Yeah, it was a good option. I think the other thing that I have noticed about not just this report, Mike, but the way that you articulate your climate action is that you come at it from multiple angles, right? There's the economic piece, which we've just talked about. You also enjoy the innovation, the tech, right? You're naturally a geek, I suppose. And I'm curious about that is an entry point into the discussion, particularly, say, with farmers around, you know, a love of innovation, a love of machinery, a love of technology. Is that a good place to start a conversation about climate?
Yeah, like, I mean, for the listeners that don't know my background, I moved back from Sydney in 2019 and started a cherry orchard because I always loved the idea of growing food. I don't know why. It's just been this thing that I've had since I was a little boy. But growing up in a suburban Wellington household didn't really give me the access to the, you know, the farming environment from which I could pursue that. So I went and got a degree in computer science at Victoria University, and long story short, built a software business that I sold, which gave me enough money to buy a farm back in New Zealand. So I moved back here in 2019. And we were starting with a blank canvas. And by the time I moved back, I think my real calling had become to do something in the climate change space next. I thought that was where I would best serve, I guess, myself, my family, as well as New Zealand, as well as the planet.
Yeah.
And I guess founding the orchard, I immediately decided I was going to go down the path of doing fully electric machines as much as I could and not diesel machines. And one of the key things I found in that whole process was that there were the number of people that were advising me not to do it because it wouldn't work or it was going to be too expensive. But I mean, I had a capital from the sale of my business and a desire just to do it. That's what entrepreneurs do. They just do things. You know, don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness is one of my favorite sayings. And so I just did it anyway. And, you know, my wife is an accountant. So we did it with a very high level of vigor in terms of we're not just frivolously throwing money away here, but we also have this disposable income to try and do something a little bit differently. And it took about 4 years to actually get to the point where we were fully electric. But that involved electrifying 21 machines on this farm that we bought. And obviously planting 9,300 cherry trees. And what was just staggering to me on the other side is just the sheer amount of savings that we make across our orchard and our household through the electrification of everything. And we're talking in the vicinity of $50,000 a year in energy savings compared to if we'd run off diesel and gas, which is what, you know, a lot of the orchards in our region run off. And and then just sort of turning that into an observational piece for farmers to come and see what it is that we've done and actually have a look at the savings and being really transparent with our numbers, all of a sudden has turned this orchard of mine in the middle of nowhere, central Otago, into something that's had, I say 10,000 visitors in 3 years. I think it could possibly be getting closer to 20,000 now. I haven't ever kept a logbook, but it's just every day there is someone new coming to see the orchard. Every day there is someone, you know, a new tour group or something like that booking in a time to come in. And, you know, we're getting busloads of people coming now to see this. And I just think it's been quite remarkable, but it's also empowered a lot of people who originally the naysayers saying it wasn't possible or it was uneconomic to do so has really empowered them to change their opinions on things because they're offering professional services and advice. They don't want to be wrong. And now that they can see this all running in action, we're starting to get a new layer of, you know, support people who on my orchard are now out there telling others that they can begin to electrify and the money and savings potential that's available, and I'm there to back it up. So, again, a really long-winded answer, but the orchard and the path that I've gone down of just doing it has probably been the single most valuable thing that I could have done. And my next goal now is, you know, we've got electric cherries in New Zealand. Where are the electric apricots and apples? Where's the electric milk? Where's the electric pork chops? I want all of these different businesses to have, you know, a commercial first, an observational point that their different peers can come along and see, because that's the way that we're going to, you know, rapidly educate, I guess, or inform New Zealand about the just significant economic savings that are available.
It depoliticizes it too, doesn't it? It takes it away from being necessarily, say, an environmental movement or a green movement, and starts it being a conversation about technology, about better business, about better management.
Yeah, I think everybody knows, whether they like to admit it or not, whether they, you know, will have a contested discussion about climate or, you know, anything like that. Everybody knows that fossil fuels contribute to climate change and that climate change is a problem. And so what I end up finding is that very rarely am I talking with our emissions the primary focus when I have one of these tour groups show up. Right. My favorite saying is one of Sir Peter Blake's sayings, which is, you know, he got suggested a lot of things throughout his career, and his answer was always yes, but does it make the boat go faster? Mm-hmm. And I think that's something in the climate movement that we've always struggled with. It's always been a very sort of very small carrot, very large stick when it's come to sort of talking about climate action. And now we have a really large carrot because technology and the plummeting cost curves of this technology allows us to have a really large carrot. So let's focus on the carrot. And yes, it just depoliticalizes everything because everybody actually gets what they want. Mm. Me as the climate activist gets the emissions reductions, you know, which is actually fantastic. Me as the farmer gets the savings. We both get what we want, so therefore we don't actually have to fight about whether the other person's values are important or not. we both just get to, you know, shake hands and go, this has been great. And that's kind of the power of it.
And someone gets to enjoy yummy cherry, which is kind of the end of the story.
Exactly.
There are other parts of our rural sector that are hard to decarbonize. And I guess I'm not really talking about carbon now. I'm talking about methane, right? We've got we've built a whole economy off the back of cows and sheep with this incredibly difficult to abate gas called methane.
Yep.
To what extent do you, you know, A, do you have an opinion about it? And is there a role, B, for a rewiring conversation in that field?
Yeah, I think this is the hardest thing. And so if you read the report, what we've done is when we separate our emissions inventory into different human decisions, it really categorizes down into two key parts, the domestic emissions and our trade emissions. And the trader emissions are obviously all the emissions that are created in New Zealand that are ultimately for products that are consumed overseas, and that's how we make our money, and that's where all the difficult conversations happen. Then we have our domestic emissions, which are the machines that underpin our lifestyles. And the trade emissions dominate the narrative, that where all the conversations are happening. That's where all the problems start to occur, where we start talking about, well, climate change is a cost. And you start to get into areas of, you know, debate around, yeah, but, you know, the climate change is going to cost more. And yes, but New Zealand's a small player in this space. Oh, yes, but we could lead the world. And it creates all this distraction. And don't get me wrong, we need to figure out how to solve that issue. Right, we really need to figure out how to solve that issue, and it's almost an issue that's so unique to New Zealand that's going to require New Zealanders to come up with the solutions to that. And it could be all sorts of options, from changing what we grow in New Zealand through to you know, different technical solutions to, I don't know, there's a lot of different things that we can look at doing, but we need time. Because agriculture makes up such a significant portion of our economy. And I'm sitting there going, wouldn't it be great if farmers were high-fiving each other every time they saw a new EV roll out on the road? Because every time we put a new EV on the road, it's solving our domestic emissions problem, and they're sort of therefore starting to buy us a bit more time. And so really what I've done with Rewiring Aotearoa, what we've done is actually just looked at focusing on what are the short-term win-win solutions. And we have funding from our philanthropists that go for 3 years. So there is no way that we're going to be in a position to be able to solve agriculture emissions in New Zealand in the next 3 years. But what we can do is put New Zealand on a clear pathway to electrification. And the one amazing thing that this report really highlights is New Zealand is possibly the first country in the world where we have reached the economic tipping point. Where electrification is now always going to be cheaper, which means right now we're in the pole position for the world's first fully electric economy. And I've sort of started to believe that's where New Zealand can really gift back to the rest of the world on climate action, is that we could be seen as the leading country in the world around electrification. One, because we have an amazing hydroelectric scheme, but the other is because we pay to the nose for fossil fuels. And so I guess what I'm saying to the listeners that might be sort of maybe cringing at this at the moment is that we have to solve our agricultural emissions. we have to figure out, you know, the solution that I'm offering around electrification certainly isn't the be-all and end-all of climate change action in New Zealand and the journey that we have to go on. But it certainly is the journey that we are, that is the lowest hanging fruit that we are already to fight on, because the economics stacks up in New Zealand possibly better than any other country to go ahead and do this now.
We've reached a point at a kind of through the election period where there was really a town and country divide happening, wasn't there, between people who were pointing at farmers as the villains of this piece because they're sitting on nearly half of our emissions coming from their activities. But what you're articulating is maybe even don't have that debate, have another debate, have another discussion, find another common enemy that could bring people together in a more helpful way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first case in point is if the methane is such a bad gas, then why are we piping it into our homes? You know, like it's just when you look at sort of the way that we look at climate action in this country, you start to realize that there's actually things that we can be doing far, far faster that align us. And I think right now we don't want to be dividing New Zealand into left and right, into climate, you know, climate activists versus climate deniers. And we certainly don't want to be dividing urban and rural people, because all it's going to do is mean that the status quo continues. So we do really need to find some common ground in this space. And I do firmly believe that electrification is that common ground, because everybody in cities and in country can save money. And one of the most amazing things is actually probably in country, you can save even more. One of the key reasons is that we drive far more Ks than the average driver in New Zealand, because we live further away from everything with no public transport. And so there is a really significant opportunity to talk about electrification being of a higher benefit to rural New Zealand, and something that they'll probably jump on, you know, because of the economics behind it. Also, we have off-street parking in rural New Zealand. We can charge our cars overnight in rural New Zealand. We can sure as hell put a lot of solar panels on our farms. And start to share that cheaper energy around with the rest of our communities as well. So there's a lot of really strong, positive things to get excited about in rural New Zealand when it comes to electrification, that I think is, yeah, where we really want to be focusing and paying our close attention to.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad you brought that out, because I guess that's kind of probably one of my last questions, is just around the opportunity that not just electrifying the machines on your farms, but perhaps also starting to think about all that open space as a source of generation, whether it's solar or wind, or, you know, some lucky people have bubbling hot springs in their backyards. What opportunities do you see if you are looking beyond this immediate report you've got here to looking at rural economies as generators of renewable electricity?
So we often talk about, so the first thing to understand for the household of New Zealand is that rooftop solar is the cheapest energy in human history. And when you annualize the cost of rooftop solar on your home, it will cost you about 6 cents a kilowatt hour, compared to probably 25 cents on average that you would buy it for from the grid. So huge, significant savings. And the economies of scale of that is multiplied when you move out on farm. We've got a lot more space on farm, a lot bigger sheds for putting rooftop solar on, but we've also got a lot of slack space available for that kind of thing. So the economies of scale really stacks up. We often talk about residential solar versus grid scale solar, or grid scale generation versus residential generation. And the big thing at the moment, you know, is talking about how we can remove consents in order to scale up renewable generation. What I don't think the government has really caught on to yet, of course, is that we want to double or even triple the amount of renewable electricity that gets consumed in New Zealand. A huge amount of that is going to come from rooftops. Why? Because the economics says it's going to come from rooftops, because it's now the cheapest energy we're ever going to get. And where farmers fit into that whole fold is that we're not residential scale. We're not grid scale, we're kind of like this medium scale where we still don't need consents to do the work. We're owner operators of the farms that we're on, and we just need to change the energy system for rewarding farmers for putting cheaper power back into the grid, power that should be shared by our communities. Like one of my favorite sayings in rewiring is, you know, the cheapest energy you're ever going to get, Vincent, is solar generated on your own rooftop. The second cheapest energy you should be getting is the solar generated on your neighbor's rooftop. Mm. And at the moment, you know, there are plenty of people who live in apartment buildings or in shady areas where solar might not stack up economically. They should be able to buy that solar much, much cheaper from their neighbors, as a way of helping their neighbors to overbuild and share that power around. But that requires a massive energy system change, because at the moment, you know that when you buy power, you're buying it at 25, 30 cents a kilowatt hour from the grid. And when you're selling it back, you're selling it at somewhere like 8 to 10 cents. And we know the physics of it suggests that an electron coming from your rooftop is going to go to your neighbors. It's not going to go all the way up and down the national transmission lines of the country. But we're still charged for every kilowatt hour that you bring in from the grid. You're still charged for that national transmission, and you're still charged for that distribution within your power bills. So there isn't, it's not really, the energy system hasn't really been designed as a grid. It's kind of been designed as a braided river that flows from one direction to the other. And so how is it now that we can get this better grid system set up for New Zealand? And that really involves changing the market. And I think a lot of that's probably going to come through farmers asking for this to happen as a way of decarbonizing what it is that they're doing. Because if they can start to earn money by being generators, they can keep the price lower for the rest of New Zealand, which is a great narrative. And it also offers them a new level of resilience, not only from natural disasters, but also a new income stream that allows them to start experimenting with what the journey is that they need to go on around changing changing the what they produce in the name of the climate. So it's a, I know that's a lot to take in, and it's a big sort of, big sort of a loop there. But essentially, I think farms could be the future power plants of New Zealand, and wouldn't that be awesome?
We're brainy people. We could handle ideas. There's a very interesting twist to that, which is that for so long, the farming lobby has been the foot draggers in environmental legislation and driving the climate agenda forward. You might find by articulating it this way that the feds and other farming lobby groups might actually become the agitators for change.
Well, that's it. And not only I know this is happening because I have spoken specifically to federated farmers about this. You know, my farm has the ability to power 100 homes during peak congestion periods, which means there's no more poles and wires needed required for the next 100 homes that get built on my local line, right? But at the moment, what's happening is where the narrative from the energy system is that we need to spend $30, $40 billion on national transmission and local distribution, which is only going to drive the power, the cost of electricity for the customer up dramatically. And so I'm sitting here going, well, actually, if we can all, as farmers, figure out how to generate our energy cheaper and get it delivered to our neighbors at a much, much cheaper rate, then there's no need for as much of this massive infrastructure build out that's going to happen. My biggest fear overall, actually, is that we know this energy transition is inevitable. And if we go and spend all this money on national transmission and local distribution, only to have everybody install solar and batteries in their homes and on their farms anyway, because it's the cheapest energy we're ever going to get, we're going to end up with a massive sunk cost on the grid, which is going to cause higher and higher prices on the grid, which is going to encourage people to start leaving the grid. And that is the worst possible outcome for New Zealand, because who's left to pay for all the infrastructure if all the wealthy people who can afford this technology now decide to leave? It's the vulnerable families and communities in New Zealand. So we need to make sure that we incentivize people to stay on the grid, and that means changing the energy system for the better to allow them to make more money than what they're currently able to make, and obviously by making more money also keep the prices lower for their neighbors. So I see farms playing a massive role in that, and something I'm really excited about. And yes, talking to federated farmers, talking to Zespri, you know, talking to a number of the different primary sector representatives out there, I think they all get quite excited about this idea, because at the end of the day, farmers are just business people. And the question is, does it make the boat go faster? Mm. And in the case of the electrification, it almost 100% of the time it does.
Yeah. And, you know, most people don't wake up in the morning and think, how can I screw the planet? But the barriers to change are difficult. And if you can articulate them in an economic way and around innovation, around being kind of, you know, trade leaders, that all works, doesn't it? It's just a different way of telling the same story.
It does. And, you know, like I have some very conservative Southland dairy farmers come to see my farm in tour groups. And you can always spot them because they're always wearing flannel shirts and they've always got their arms folded, you know, when you're talking. And I point them out and I say, you sir, look like a skeptic. And they'll always say, yes, I am a bit of a skeptic, you know, because farmers are very genuine, honest, open people at the same time. And I always say to them, well, you're coming on a tour and the only person's opinion who I really care about at the end of this is yours. And can you give me a rating of 8 out of 10 as to what your thoughts are at the end of this? Once we've been through this tour and spoken through all the numbers, and the answer is always 8 out of 10. And I think that's just a remarkable, you know, a remarkable sort of demonstration of how it is that this can be a really, really powerful thing. I'm not there telling him he needs to reduce his stock numbers. I'm not there telling him, you know, that his business is bad for the planet or that he's bad for the planet. I'm here going, this is how you can save some money and make your business better. And they just jump fully on board with that. But to start off with, they come very reserved because they're afraid that I'm there to tell them that everything that they're doing is wrong.
Just in the couple of minutes that remain, Mike, where do you get your energy from? Because it's tough, you know, it's hard enough being a horticulturalist, but now you're throwing your energy into this, unless you're just sitting on piles of cash and you've got nothing better to do.
You meant motivational energy. I thought you were talking about where my farm.
Yeah, we've moved from hardware to software. You personally, what drives you?
That's a really good question. I think the first thing that drove me into focusing more on climate was, of course, having my children. I have three beautiful children. One, my daughter, who is 10 years old now, has always been asking us what we're doing for the climate, you know. So I think that's always been one of the key things. The second thing is I am an entrepreneur who dives incredibly deep into things. And so what has excited me more than anything from building the orchard has been seeing the response that it's got and the learning opportunities for New Zealanders. What has been afforded to me now, which I'm very, very grateful for, is the opportunity to move far beyond my farm and start talking to the whole of New Zealand about this. And so essentially I was at a bit of crossroads. I'd finished electrifying the orchard, but I didn't have the capital capacity to go buy another farm and go again. And also, you know, how do I change this from linear growth to exponential growth? Mm. And that's where I met the team from Rewiring Aotearoa, who invited me to eventually become the CEO of Rewiring Aotearoa, and where I went to a whole bunch of philanthropists in New Zealand, told them my story, told them our vision to, you know, there's 21 electric machines on my farm, but there's 10 million small fossil fuel machines in New Zealand. How do we electrify those as quickly as possible? And having them fall in love with the positive narrative. And now I'm in a situation where we're really a well-funded charity organization that does what I really see as being the best climate action possible in the next few years, the accelerated climate action that actually gets, you know, some form of results that is quantifiable. Mm. So that's sort of where I get my energy from. It's not to say that, you know, nobody else's climate action is more important than mine. It's not. Mine is more important than theirs. Sorry, it's definitely not the case. Like I admire anyone who is in this climate space fighting for a greater world for our children. I've just caught on to the one thing that I think is mm-hmm. is an incredibly valuable narrative that seems to puncture into communities and you know, that might otherwise have not been on board with the climate narrative up to this point. And I guess that's what excites me, is just to go out there and get my hands dirty and try and make a difference.
Good on you. Well, it's
thank
it's
you working,
and it's infectious, you know. I think keep it up, you know. It's such a breath of fresh air to have such a positive force come in, and I'm loving the angles, you know, into this that have changed the conversation and your point about the Southland farmer, I just think it's so powerful to have a different narrative.
And I think, the different narrative, and like I've done an incredible amount of personal growth, which I'm really grateful for in this space. Like I still have so much imposter syndrome that this software developer from Wellington who bought a cherry farm is now, you know, sort of one of the leaders, I guess, in this space. There's a lot of people that know an awful lot more about me, about emissions accounting and inventory and things like that. And I guess what I'm trying to say there is I still half the time have no idea what I'm doing, but I'm here to give it a damn good crack. And I'm really enjoying giving it a crack. And I'm really enjoying discussing with other people in the space and working out key ways that we can collaborate so that our narratives don't get in the way of each other. We do have to, I'm talking to farmers about electrification. Someone else is talking to farmers about methane. Both of those things are incredibly important things that New Zealand has to solve. So how can we solve them together?
But Mike, are your cherries any good?
50% of all New Zealanders are able to pick out electric cherries in a blind taste test.
I can't believe that, but I'm. It sounds good.
So my cherries are amazing. What a lot of New Zealanders, just to spruik cherries, and this is not just my cherries. This is Central Otago cherries in particular. We grow hands down the best cherries in the world, but the best cherries in the world are harvested after Christmas, and they all go overseas because by the time we get back from our Christmas holidays, no one wants to buy cherries anymore. So if there's one thing that you can do to become a cherry connoisseur is to be figuring out how to buy export quality cherries from the farmer in the middle of January when the best cherries in New Zealand come off the shelves that people in Taiwan are paying hundreds of dollars a kilo for.
All right, well, it's either you or someone at Turners and Growers might be able to help them out.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Good. Lovely talking to you, Mike. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Vincent. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to This Climate Business. If you like the show, please rate us as it helps others to find us. Ka kite anō.